This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. 54 each day, according to the Ovarian Cancer Research Alliance. That's how many people in the U.S. learn they have ovarian cancer. In past years, that diagnosis left little room for hope because the cancer typically went undetected until it reached later stages. But advancements in treatment, thanks to research and lessons from ovarian cancer survivors themselves, have changed that. And organizations like St. Louis Ovarian Cancer Awareness is part of ensuring that improvement continues. Since 2005, its Survivors Teaching Students program has worked with medical schools and institutions in the STL region. Here to discuss how programs like Survivors Teaching Students prepare physicians and help save lives, we have Dr. Andrea Hageman, gynecologic oncologist. Welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
We also have Dr. Ian Hageman, professor of pathology and immunology at WashU School of Medicine. Welcome to you as well.
It's nice to be here.
So, Dr. Andrea, ovarian cancer is sneaky. We noted that ovarian cancer tends to go undetected until it's reached those later stages. Before we address that, though, how is it that you explain to your patients what ovarian cancer is?
I think it's hard to put into a quick soundbite what ovarian cancer is, mm-hmm. but you know, these are cells that originated from the ovary that may be contained within the ovary when we find them, or they may have spread to the upper abdomen or other places in the body when we find it. Mm-hmm. So we can find it, as you mentioned, at various stages, mm-hmm. and basically these are cells that have grown usually quite quickly,
right?
And we need to usually treat with a combination of surgery and possibly chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm. And does cancer metastasize easily compared maybe to other kinds of cancer?
Well, I think what is hard is to find when it metastasizes early, mm-hmm. Or to find that. Some ovarian masses grow big quickly, and we find them when they're still confined to the ovary. Mm-hmm. But many of the cancers, unfortunately, they start from the surface of the ovary, or in fact the fallopian tube, and spread to the upper abdomen quite quickly before they've shown any signs of growing bigger in the ovary, so they wouldn't be detected on a normal pelvic exam. Mm-hmm.
Who's most at risk, Dr. Andrea?
Yeah, I think the biggest risk factors are, first of all, family history and genetics. So if you have BRCA1 or 2 mutation or a strong family history of breast and ovarian cancer, that's probably the biggest risk factor we know of. The other is length of time you've had ovulation or had menstrual cycles. So people who have had more pregnancies, more time breastfeeding, that actually decreases the risk. We know that actually oral contractives decrease the risk because they suppress ovulation. There's a whole list of things, general, it kind of comes back to how much time those ovaries have cycled each month for many years.
Right. Dr. Ian, the symptoms patients do show are usually misdiagnosed as common and much less serious conditions. And this is part of what permits ovarian cancer to develop before diagnosis. What is it that you teach your students to look out for insofar as ovarian cancer is concerned?
Yeah, so we have a phrase in medicine that common things are common, and the symptoms of ovarian cancer tend to be very subtle. It used to be referred to as the killer that whispers. And sometimes we still think of these symptoms as being kind of like a whisper. They start gradually. There are changes in pant size. Your clothes don't fit quite as well. Mm-hmm. Feelings of indigestion, or one of our survivors says, always hungry, always full. Mm-hmm. Feeling hungry, taking one bite, and feeling full. So the key that we teach our students is thinking of ovarian cancer or other malignancies, thinking outside the box and having a complete, what we call differential diagnosis, remembering to think of it, because if you don't think of it, you can't test for it.
Right. So just an increase sort of consciousness about it, awareness.
That's right. Awareness. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's probably why the name awareness is right there in the name of this organization, St. Mm-hmm. Louis Ovarian Cancer Awareness.
Right. Are there any known environmental factors connected to ovarian cancer that you have found in the research that you've done? Dr. Ian?
So there's some thought that there may be environmental exposures. There's been a lot of attention in the news to possible role of talcum powder or environmental contaminants as a cause of ovarian cancer. As a pathologist, I would say the jury is still out on that question. It hasn't been definitively established in the medical literature, but there's clearly a lot of interest in possible environmental exposures.
Right. Dr. Andrea, you mentioned earlier pant size. Was that Dr. Ian? You did. In your experience as a medical practitioner, what's one of the other, or maybe a couple other physical changes that patients who do have ovarian cancer cite as their reason for going to see their doctor?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I think a lot of our patients have been mentioning these symptoms for some time, but as Ian mentioned, these are pretty common symptoms. It's very uncommon to be a woman and not have ever experienced bloating.
Right.
So it's not, and when I was a medical student learning about these symptoms, I diagnosed myself with ovarian cancer, you know, multiple times, and I thankfully haven't experienced that actually. So, but I think that the fact is these symptoms are there and you just sort of take them like, well, this is just part of being a woman. So, but ascites, which is fluid that the cancer cells can make that really distends the abdomen, can make the abdomen look like almost like a beach ball, very tense with fluid. Mm-hmm. And so that is something that's different than just like regular bloating. It might be getting worse. And we often say that if these symptoms are there 10 times a month, more than just like a little random bloating every now and then. But if you can count that this is different than prior, it's now happening 10 times or more a month, that's definitely time to seek attention and almost just sort of keep asking for more tests to work that up, because that is not normal.
What kinds of tests are we talking about?
Yeah, so I think the biggest workup that we have for a pelvic mass, which is not always cancer and most of the time isn't actually, would be an ultrasound. So our common thought is like, why doesn't every woman get an ultrasound? The problem is, like I mentioned before, a lot of these ovarian cancers actually go quickly from the ovary before they get bigger. So we might not even detect an abnormality on the ultrasound. Some of these things will be found actually by a CT scan. So that gets to the abdomen and pelvis, and we can see actually where the cancer has spread to the omentum, which is a fatty layer of tissue that overlies our bowels. That can show up on a CT scan more than anything. We also have a marker, a blood test that people can have called a CA125, also a common workup for a pelvic mass. Not recommended for a routine screening, but when these symptoms are happening, a combination of an ultrasound, CT scan, and CA125 can be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Ian, ovarian cancer, is there something that makes it very distinct from other kinds of cancer?
A thing that's unique about the cancers that arise in the abdomen inside the abdominal cavity is that there are a lot of different places that the tumor can spread to that are accessible to those cells. And so relatively early in their course, they can spread around to different surfaces, to the surface of the bowel, the omentum that we heard about just now. Something that's unique about ovarian cancer compared to some other gynecologic cancers is that it does not usually present with bleeding, with vaginal bleeding. Uh-huh. And that is part of why it can be perceived as a silent disease. If a woman notices a change in vaginal bleeding or in menses or starts bleeding when she believed herself to be postmenopausal, that can send her to the doctor. But ovarian cancer usually does not present with vaginal bleeding.
Mm-hmm. Are there any challenges to researching ovarian cancer?
So many challenges. Yeah,
that's right. That's why we're here. One of the challenges is that we're not yet completely sure what the precursors are, what the cells of origin are for some of the types of ovarian cancer. Another is how many different types of ovarian cancer there are. There are several dozen different cell types. If we really were to cone down to the subtype of the subtype, and several of them probably have different origin stories.
Mm-hmm. We have Linda calling from Crestwood with a question. Linda, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you. I am a DES daughter, and I was wondering how that figures into my likelihood of being a ovarian cancer patient.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and
it's a great question.
And please, what does DES mean?
Yes. So DES stands for diethylstilbestrol, which is something that a lot of women in the past were given to help with pregnancy symptoms. So women who were taking that when they were pregnant, actually their daughters were born with potentially this exposure that increases their likelihood of gynecologic cancers. Mm-hmm. Specifically, we think about clear cell cancers, typically of the vagina or cervix, but could be with any of the reproductive organs. It's interesting because once that was found out, that's no longer used anymore, and we don't necessarily see many people like you, Linda, which is wonderful at this point. But mm-hmm. for you, I think just continue to discuss with your gynecologist increased screening. We often do increased screening for the cervix, cervical cancer specifically, and ultimately some people end up having hysterectomies or removal of their tubes and ovaries, which ultimately is honestly the best way we can prevent, if it makes sense, the risks and balances way out to do a surgery to prevent that cancer. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to say that for you exactly, but just in terms of continuing to discuss with your gynecologist.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Ian, is there anything you have to add to that?
So DES was banned in the mid-70s. Yeah. It was a drug that was given to promote healthy babies, to prevent miscarriages among the mothers. So it's an example of unintended consequences. I think it's a good example of how our public health apparatus can identify risks to health and intervene to ensure healthy medicines are in our medical system.
Right.
And the importance of research on all of it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Now, both of you have worked with the St. Louis Ovarian Cancer Awareness organization called SLOCA for short, for about a decade now. And one of its programs, Survivors Teaching Students, features ovarian cancer survivors talking very specifically and intentionally with medical students, in other words, with future physicians. And what they share is their experiences from the moment of diagnosis through medical treatment and their reactions to it. And those personal accounts include how their doctors treated them medically and personally. St. Louis Ovarian Cancer Awareness's program director, Robin Hunter, said survivor stories are key to the future of understanding and treating ovarian cancer.
Some of these women got diagnosed late because they were being told to go to different providers that said, I think it's a urinary thing. I think it's a gastro thing. Before an OB finally saw what it could be. So, unfortunately, unless they hear what these women went through and hear it for themselves from the source, ovarian cancer, unless they have firsthand knowledge of it, is not necessarily on their radar. And it's also because the signs are so subtle, or could be attributed to other diagnoses, I think it's important to hear from these women that they need to advocate for themselves in order to say, I know my body better than anybody, and it's not normal for me to have these symptoms that have been going on for months.
That was Robin Hunter, program director for St. Louis Ovarian Cancer Awareness. We're talking about ovarian cancer with Drs. Andrea Hagerman, who is a gynecologic oncologist, and Dr. Ian Hagerman, who is a WashU School of Medicine professor of pathology and immunology. So much of what Robin Hunter said there, Dr. Ian, are points that you have brought up, as well as you, Dr. Andrea, that you have mentioned already. But what is it that as practitioners, as a researcher, that you have learned from the personal stories that have been shared by survivors. Dr. Andrea?
Well, one of the highlights of my job is helping women through this, through these diagnoses and helping them understand their body, but also learning what their perspective has been through it and listening. I think that this is a organization and an opportunity for our students to practice listening, and that goes a long way for the rest of their career, no matter what specialty they choose, mm-hmm. and specifically listening to women about the symptoms that were affecting their reproductive tract. So mm-hmm. I think that alone, number one benefit of this program.
Dr. Ian, you work with students regularly, in addition to the research that you're doing. Do you recall there being anything akin to survivors teaching students when you were in med school?
There's a long tradition in medical education of having presentations by patients, often brought by one of the lecturers in a given course, in order to illustrate the points that are being made. This program is new and unique. Well, it's not new anymore. It's more than 10 years old, but mm-hmm. is unique in bringing gynecologic cancer patients. Gynecologic cancers are sometimes a little bit under-recognized. They can be difficult to talk about. Breast cancer is an example of a disease that we're now more willing to talk about. We're less willing to talk about endometrial and ovarian cancer than we ever were. And so this may be the one hour in their medical education when the students are laser-focused on the survivors of this one specific disease, ovarian cancer.
Mm-hmm. How have the students themselves responded to the stories that survivors share?
They're grateful. I think they're very grateful to have had the opportunity to listen, to ask their questions. There's a destigmatization that happens when they're invited to ask any question they can think of. And they engage. There's always a moment after the survivors give their presentations and tell their stories when the first person is gearing up to ask their question. And then the questions come. They have many of them. We run out of time every time. And the questions are usually not about the science. They're usually about the experience of illness. Mm. What was it like? What did a doctor do that helped you? What can we do better when we're doctors?
Right. Now, just like any cancer, ovarian cancer affects each individual very differently. You know, warning signs can fly under the radar for a long time. And a survivor who has shared her story with your class, Dr. Ian, is Catherine Millikay. And she told producer Maya Norfleet what her life was like before diagnosis and that it included training for the Chicago Marathon.
You know, whenever you train, there's lots of running. So I felt like that made me, I used to tell myself after a run, you know, you're bulletproof and invincible. It was very empowering. But then, you know, kind of took a different direction and started, I thought, well, you're going to have to stay in the workforce a long time. And if you want to advance your career, you're going to need to get a master's degree. So I went back to school. I was working full time and got that master's degree and then started just applying for jobs. Even if they were out of town, I just wanted to advance my career. I wanted to make more money. Because I wanted to, you know, there's practical realities to everyone's life. You know, I wanted to be able to retire and I wanted to pay off, you know, have my mortgage paid off. And so that was a pretty stressful time and things didn't exactly work out. And then it was shortly thereafter in 2018 when I was diagnosed.
That was Catherine Millikay, one of the volunteers who shares her personal ovarian cancer experience through St. Louis Ovarian Cancer Awareness's program, Survivors Teaching Students. Another participant is Joan Gummels. And in Ian's most recent class, she shared her thoughts on what living with ovarian cancer looks like to her.
Living with metastatic cancer is really an exercise in controlling terror. You know, somehow not letting it dominate your life. But ultimately, I had to ask myself, if this somehow shortens my life, is that okay? And that's when I realized there's more to life than just not dying, just subsisting. If I have to live with cancer, it has to live with me, meaning my life is bigger than my condition. So it's hard to always remember that when side effects at times limit my ability to enjoy things I love doing. but it's important to hold on to that perspective. I wanted to share that with the class because they're treating a condition, but they're dealing with the whole person. And, you know, I don't envy their position because every person is so different and comes loaded with baggage they have to somehow figure out to treat the person as well as the condition.
That was Joan Gummels, another of the volunteers who shares her ovarian cancer survival story in Survivors Teaching Students. Dr. Andrea, that statement, there's more to life than just not dying. And Joan's point about doctors treating not just the condition, but a person. What does treating the condition and the person look like in practice?
Yeah, well, it's, first of all, a huge privilege to step into someone's life during this time. And I think the goal is to always do it with a sense of compassion and respect for what they've brought into this life before their diagnosis of cancer. And so we often talk about goals of care because we're meeting people at different times, or we may have followed people for, you know, 10 years for this cancer, where, you know, in the beginning of the cancer course, we're easily able to treat it with surgery, with chemotherapy. And cancer cells are very smart. They try to find ways to resist the treatment that we have, and we're trying to be smarter and give them targeted therapies right back at it. But all of these things take the toll on the body, and ultimately our goal is to provide palliation during the treatment too, which means feeling better because we're giving treatment. So how are we doing that? Every time we see people, we have to ask them, are we meeting that goal? What are your goals? And not just to live longer, but to live fully. What does that mean to you? So it's looking at the family surrounding the patients. It's not just the patient. They always come, you know, usually with family members who care and love them so much. And so how do we work together to work with our whole staff, not just the doctors, to our nurses, our research staff, everyone who is helping take care of the patients? How do we all work together to make that experience acceptable, and hopefully more than acceptable, but, respectful and dignified?
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to give the last 30 seconds to you, Dr. Ian. What difference do you know it makes for there to be greater awareness about ovarian cancer?
We would love for patients to be diagnosed earlier, as early as possible. So that's a huge goal, is to help our graduates at the medical school, no matter what specialty they choose, to remember to work up patients for ovarian cancer and other gynecologic malignancies so they can be diagnosed more quickly and have access to more effective treatment. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Ian Hageman is a WashU School of Medicine professor of pathology and immunology, and Dr. Andrea Hageman is a gynecologic oncologist. Dr. Andrea and Dr. Ian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you
so much.
This episode was produced by Maya Norfleet.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Dorr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.